Kara's mail.
Randy J. Cabrigo, students at University of Portland, students of Joe and Dave. And I'm here all for one of our projects at the University of School.
Welcome. If you can take a moment and look over the meeting notes from last month, any revisions or edits, move along the agenda.
A motion to approve.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right, thank you. Moving on to the department update, Roxanne.
Yes, so Dr. Melnick is in Walla Walla, so I am taking his place tonight. And some of you may have heard that we had some interesting happenings at our harm reduction center. I don't know if you've heard about that or not. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the harm reduction center or what we do. We have a facility that we rent with Cascade AIDS Project. And we do some work out of there. Not only do we do STD clinics and HIV prevention work, but we also do our needle exchange program and our naloxone program that Adiba and Sandy will be talking about later tonight. But unfortunately, we had a really bad sewage backup at the harm reduction center about a week or so ago. And Mark, you may be able to jump in on this. It was a third level, which is the worst, if my understanding correct, sewage. Do you know?
Okay,
put you on the spot. So it was a very bad sewage leak. And what happened was the facility was being hooked up to the sewer system, and we were decommissioning the dry well, and something happened, and something went wrong, and we had a really bad sewage leak. So the whole facility was shut down, and we are going to be shut down for probably 3 to 4 weeks. But the great thing is the team came together very, very quickly, and we're still doing services. And I wanted to give a shout out to Sandy and the team, because you guys have done an absolutely awesome job. Not only did we work with CAP to the Cascades AIDS Project to reassign patients to some facilities in Portland, but they were also able to put a mobile unit together to continue to provide needle exchange program through in the parking lot of the Harm Reduction Center through our mobile service. So they were able to institute that very, very quickly, and they worked with our on-site emergency response team to do that, and they just did an excellent job. So everybody, what's so great about it, too, is that all of our clients that come through there, it was set up in such a way that it's still very, very private, and people are still getting the services they need. So we're going to be down for about 4 weeks as they're putting together, or as they're rehabbing the old facility. I think it's going to be a greater version of what we had there before. So we're going to get new flooring, we're putting in a new bathroom. So we're taking this opportunity to really upgrade the facility. So I think it's going to be even better once it's all finished. We also are a facility here where the VA vacated. We have some clinic space, so we're going to be doing some temporary STD services out of this facility in England as well. So Sandy, is there anything else you wanted to add?
Says it all.
Okay.
They're having to smell better too.
Yes, definitely. In many ways. So that's the update on the Harm Reduction Center. Now that your mouth is full.
Mm-hmm. So okay. Only a few cookie crumbs are gonna come out. I had the honor of going to my stepdaughter's high school graduation and award ceremony, and fortunately for me, Bryce is also in her class, and so I got to see him get his awards. And I just wanted to acknowledge Bryce because he did amazing. So they'd have students come up in groups. I don't think Bryce sat down very much. He kept coming with every group. He was, do you want to give a highlight of all the, you've got a lot of scholarships.
Thank you.
He was the top 5%.
So I was recognized amongst the top 5%
of the school. I was also recognized as being an officer at my school's National Honor Society, as well as receiving the Washington Scholars Award, which recognizes me as one of the top 1% students in the 49th Legislative District.
That's exactly what I was going to say. You can see I was not in that position when I was at school. And my name is... But anyways, congratulations, Bryce. That was exciting.
Good. For the executive committee update, we had a recent news release by the Clark County Public Health. There's some vacancies that are coming up. We have, I believe, five individuals' terms that are coming up and expiring soon. Specifically for those individuals that would represent the public and or specific disciplines within the county. A consumer of public health services, doctor of veterinary medicine, representative from Clark County Youth Commission, and representative of Clark County Septic Designers. So currently we have Betsy Brownfield, who's serving in the capacity of veterinary medicine, Joe Cowley, non-elected rep, a consumer of public health, Mark Collier, obviously, I think it's been here since the inception, in regards to Clark County Septic Contractors and Installers, and Joanne Huffman, also a consumer of public health. Julie had mentioned to me at the top of the meeting that it's on a rotating basis, so every 3 years, 4 to 5 positions become available to the general public, so that doesn't mean that the incumbents cannot put in for consideration, they can't put in for consideration of the board. So that term, or those terms, will be October 1st, 2015 through September 30th, 2017. And the application deadline looks like it's going to be mid-August, August 13th of this year. So that was a press release dated June 12th. Anything else to add on that specifically, Julie? I know there were some emails earlier this week that were sent notifying specific individuals.
Nothing other than the fact that the council, the Board of County Councilors, they are the ones who will make the selection in all instances except for Joan's position, because the City of Vancouver actually advertises and selects that position on the council. But you're all, everybody who's on the council and currently, and they want to re-up, if they, you know, you are welcome to apply. It doesn't guarantee that you'll be selected. It's their game. That's all.
Thank you. And in regards to the youth representative, as you heard, Bryce is slated to go off to college this summer, Bryce University in Texas. Might be a little bit warmer there than this year, I'm not certain. So your last meeting will be next month. So thank you for serving in advance. We appreciate it. You've done an excellent job. Moving to the legislative update.
Yeah, so we have a couple of updates to give you. I'm going to skip to the distribution of funds first. Actually, that letter is from the Board of Health is actually on hold right now. But we did get a couple of other letters that are in your packet from the Board of Health. And these are letters that we had actually talked about, I think, at the last meeting. So the first one is for the Coordinated Prevention Grant Funding. And basically what that is that the funds for that come to us. They're, I believe, federal and state funds that come to us. Jeff, is that correct? Are they federal and state funds that come to us? State funds. And they're looking at actually cutting those funds to the local health jurisdictions by about 50%. And so there's a significant concern about that because we use those funds for solid waste enforcement. And it actually does appear, the letter that was sent out by the Board of Health was very appreciated. However, it does look like that's likely to pass in the state budget. We're not sure yet, but it's likely to actually happen. So our environmental health folks in the state have been meeting to look at different options available to us to share the available funds that will be allocated. So we're in the process of working on those contingency plans right now, and we'll have further updates for you. Depending on where this ends up, we'll have some further updates for you in the future. Alrighty. The second letter in your packet is actually for the vaping legislation, House Bill 1645. And this is the bill, if you guys recall, was going to prevent sale of vaping devices and vaping paraphernalia to minors, which is outstanding. And that actually does look like it has a pretty good chance of passing. However, there was an associated bill attached to it, which was 2211. And it was basically a taxation. So they were looking at taxing vaping products for about 60%. 40% of that was slated to come back to the local health jurisdictions for or public health for education. So it's kind of being held up in the state right now. There has not been a whole lot of activity on it, so I don't have an update for you about where this is going. The Board of Health actually did submit this letter. They are supportive of 1645. They're not supportive of 2211 because of the taxation element, but they did ask, if it does pass, that we do get that 40%. So we were very appreciative of the letter that the Board of Health sent. Any questions on those things? Okay. And then I also want to give you a quick update on, there's been some media around House Bill 2263. Some of you may have heard this in the news lately in the media. And it looks like there's a fair amount of support for this at the state level, and there's some local support for it as well. And what this bill is it's actually a 0.1% sales tax increase for affordable housing and mental health services and mental health facilities. And they have a specific population that this is aimed at. The population is includes those whose income is at or below 60% of the area median income in the county. And the focus are also on veterans, seniors, homeless families with children, unaccompanied homeless youth, persons with disabilities, and domestic violence survivors. And 60% of the funding must be used for the purposes of those mental health services for that population and for affordable housing. If the local counties do not approve this, if it goes through, and it does look like it's got some pretty good support right now, but if local counties do not approve this, then cities will have the option to approve it within 2 to 3 years. So basically what the state is doing is saying it's leaving it up to the counties to vote yes or no on this. If the counties decide not to take any action, then the cities do have the option of putting this tax in place within about 2 to 3 years, depending on the size of the counties. Right now, our Board of Health is not in support of, our Board of Commissioners is not supportive of this. However, it looks like Vancouver, the City of Vancouver is. And there's a few other community partners, the Healthy Living Collaborative, Vancouver Housing Authority, and the Council of the Homeless that are in support of this right now. So we're not asking you for anything. I just want to give you an update because it has been in the media, so you may be hearing some more about it. So are there any questions on that?
What was the legislation number?
It's legislation. It's House Bill 2263. And that is all for the legislative update for right now.
And and the councilors didn't support it, which is a tax increase. Yeah. That's the only reason.
It's as far as I know, that's the only reason they're not supportive of it because of that, yes.
So the proposed sales tax increase, is there a order of magnitude as far as the revenue projection?
We probably can get some projections for you. The projections I saw were not due from this tax, but from a similar tax in the past. So there's no real fiscal update at this point that I could provide to you now, but we can certainly bring that back for maybe the July meeting.
Great.
Okay, thank you.
We'll move to the public health in action. As we had mentioned, I believe at our last meeting in May, trying to spotlight specific public health in action regarding a specific area, just to give quick examples of all the good things that are happening throughout the county With that, we have Aviva and Sandy to give us an update in regards to the overdose prevention as well as the shrinkage exchange update at the harm reduction center. Thank you.
So we'd like to give you a little background about Strange Exchange Services. Our Strange Exchange in Clark County has been around for about 23 years now. It's changed over the years, but there's always been a volunteer element. So currently we have about 15 volunteers. I'm the only full-time staff that actually half of my time, but I'm the only staff member that paid to work with Stranger Exchange Services. The premise of Stranger Exchange is harm reduction. So harm reduction means that we meet people where they're at in their use and in recovery and help them stay as healthy as they can possibly can. And also their families and the community that they're in. So we have anonymous services and non-judgmental. So people build a rapport with our staff and they feel comfortable coming in. They're pretty brave to walk in the front door and say that they're there for Stranger Exchange Services, but over time, they really realize that it's a safe space, and it really helps to reduce their harm because they're learning a lot by being there. The exchange is open 8 hours a week, 3 days a week, and the services include a one-for-one needle exchange. So they bring in a needle, they get a needle back, and we don't require that they bring in needles, but we really encourage it. Because we want to keep those needles off the street and out of the hands of other people. We also do hepatitis C testing. We do a rapid test that takes about 20 minutes and people get results for hep C. We do hepatitis A and B vaccines because people that are injecting also are at risk for hepatitis A and B because of their behaviors. We have many community referrals and information about community resources. We give safe injection supplies, and primarily we're giving educational interventions to reduce harm to people. So we talk about safe injection and safe disposal and safe use. And we a year ago we added the overdose prevention project because it was a ultimate harm reduction because we're saving lives by preventing overdose prevention and overdose death. We serve about 1,500 individual clients in about 6,000 visits. Our client population has nearly doubled over the last 5 years, and the number of new clients enrolling annually has increased by 50%. About 30% of our client population is less than 24 years of age. And we get this information because we enter information into a database based on that anonymous number that we assign people. Secondary exchange is permitted and encouraged because it widens the exchange for peers that are unable to come in to exchange. So every person that comes in, there's two people receiving secondary exchange. So for the number of people that are coming in, it's about double the reach. Needle exchange averages about 40 clients a month, and we distribute about 100,000 syringes a month. In the past year, we distributed and disposed of about 1.2 million syringes. So keeping those syringes off the street keeps our streets and parks clean and our waterways can have a yield on them. Heroin is the primary drug of choice for about 70% of our syringe exchange clients. Well, 30% of our clients primarily use methamphetamine. In a survey that we did several years ago, we found that about 60% of our clients that are using heroin currently were prescribed opiates before they became addicted. We have some great community partnerships that we've developed over the years. We currently have a lifeline drug and alcohol counselor at our exchange one day a week, and he tries to make access easier to get into detox, to get into the sobering unit and treatment by providing information and decreasing barriers for that. We have an in-person assistor that can sign people up for health insurance and give them access, and she actually fills out the application while people are in front of her and gets them on insurance and they're able to use it the next day. We have Yellow Brick Road that comes once a month. Yellow Brick Road is a street outreach for homeless youth or those at risk of becoming homeless. And we also have a relationship with them that they can collect syringes from youth. And then we have a voucher system for the youth to be able to come in and get syringes. Youth are 24 and older, or 24 and under. We're all youth. We're also part of a Tri-County Needle Exchange group, so we share supplies sometimes, we share information, so that's Multnomah, Washington, and Clark County. And we also work really closely with CAP because we share the building with them, but also we share some clients and we do HIV prevention work.
Cool, well, I actually used to volunteer with City of Exchange while I was doing my MBH, so it's just really exciting that I get to continue working with the program, doing some of their data analysis for them. So I really enjoy working with the program. So I'm just going to share with you some of the stats and some of the the data that we've been looking at before we actually started the overdose prevention program. It's been a long time coming. We've been talking about it for years. But as you all know, overdose is the leading cause of accidental death in the state of Washington, more than double the rate of motor vehicle accidents. And so if you look at the graphs on the bottom of the on the handout there, you see that in the state of Washington, most of the deaths are accounted for by prescription pain medications. So that's on the left-hand side of the red line, statewide, it's starting to level off, but in Clark County, we're actually seeing increasing rates of heroin-related overdose deaths. It's been about a 70% increase since 2008, where we kind of see prescription opiate-related overdose coming down and heroin-related overdose coming up. So based on this data and hospitalization data as well, on the back you'll see hospitalizations that are opiate-related have increased by 94% in 2013. We saw 525 opiate-related hospitalizations. So, you know, based on this work and all the work that's been happening nationally on opiate overdose prevention, we decided that we really needed to be doing something, especially at our harm reduction center, to make it a comprehensive program and offer these services. So, in the state of Washington, the Good Samaritan law legalizes prescribing and possession of naloxone, which is the antidote for opiate, specifically opiate-related overdose, to anyone that's at risk of an overdose themselves, or a family member, or a friend, or a peer, anyone who could potentially be a witness of an opiate overdose. And so, using Duffinomics prescribing authority, we've been working under a standing order to have staff and volunteers do naloxone distribution and training with clients, and Sandy can share a little bit more about the program, but we've not only been working with clients, but a lot of different partner organizations and other professionals in the community that interface with populations that are at risk. So, Sandy can talk a little bit about the program.
So we really wanted the program to be user-friendly, pardon the pun, but we wanted our clients to be empowered to feel like they could use naloxone and prevent overdose in themselves and in their peers. So we made it, the messaging very simple. And we started out by talking to clients about overdose prevention within itself, because if people are overdosing, they're more likely to die of overdose, but we don't want them to overdose. So thinking about why people overdose, most people overdose because they take a little break from the drug or the medication, and not just heroin users, but people that are using prescription medications. They take a little break or use the wrong amount and find themselves overdosing. So talking to people about primary prevention is a really important part of it. And then the messaging is really simple. Call 911, do rescue breathing, and use naloxone. So we tell people calling 911 is a safety for you, because if the naloxone doesn't work, you have a backup. Rescue breathing is to give oxygen to the brain. So if you don't give oxygen to the brain will die eventually. So with or without naloxone, rescue breathing can bring somebody back. And then using naloxone and how to use it safely. If the person is not overdosing, it doesn't hurt the person. It's a benign medication. We also talk to people about how to recognize symptoms of overdose. If they don't respond to pain or noise, they're probably overdosing. So don't put them in the shower. Don't leave them alone. How to really treat that seriously. So we trained all of our staff and volunteers how to teach overdose prevention to our clients and how to show them how to use naloxone. So it takes about 15 minutes to do a really good little class on overdose prevention and how to use the naloxone, but if the person has 3 minutes, we'll do it in 3 minutes. We want the person to leave with that information. We give a naloxone kit, which includes the naloxone and then enough supplies to use the naloxone. So a couple of alcohol wipes, a couple pairs of gloves, a mask that we use to do rescue breathing, and instructions. We encourage people to stay at home and talk to their peers and their family members and talk to them about the fact that they have this kit and teach others how to use it, because you can't use it on yourself. Many clients have tried to be creative and thinking about falling on the needle with an naloxone.
Wow.
It doesn't work. So talking to their peers and to their family about the fact that they have the kit and where it's stored and how to use it in case of an overdose.
So as part of the program, we have an evaluation component where we have every client that comes in to get a kit fill out an enrollment form, and there we're able to collect some demographics and risk factors associated with their use and their history and overdose risk. So we've been able to track a little bit about who we're actually training, and then in order to track how many of these kits are actually being used, when folks come back for a refill, we have them fill out a form to describe whether or not they used it and describe the incident, what drug they used, did they call the police, etc. So we actually developed these, the database and the forms based on a lot of other communities that have been doing this for years, and like City, San Francisco, Chicago. Portland started a year before we did. So we started in April of 2014, so just a little over a year ago. So we just had our 1 year anniversary of the program. And so over the course of the first year, we trained 259 individuals, combination of clients and professional staff. Most were exchange clients, and about 10% were staff either from Clark County or from other partner organizations, including like Lifeline, other chemical dependency programs, and homeless shelters as well, the volunteers. We asked them about risk factors. So, as Andy mentioned earlier, overdose risk increases for people who take some time off, or if they've recently been incarcerated, or if they spend the night on the street for shelter. So about half of our clients, 54%, reported either recently being in detox, jail, in the ER, spending the night on the street for shelter, or taking a few days off for any of those. And so we are seeing a high risk population who are training. We also asked them about other habits that put them at increased risk, about whether they combine alcohol with opioids, whether they use sedatives or downers with opioids, whether they use alone, and whether they use in public. And 30 to 40% combine their drugs, so they are at increased risk. And most of our clients, over 75%, are using alone, and that's one of the things that's part of the training, to not use alone, and to train your family and your peers, fellow users, and that you have the naloxone and how to use it. About 40% of our clients say that they've experienced one or more overdose in their lifetime, and over 40% have witnessed an overdose. In the first year, we gave out a total of 497 kits. Each kit has two naloxone vials. And we completed 238 refills, and over 100 of them, 106, were actually reversals that were reported back to us. And this is a huge underestimate, because a lot of the refills are people coming in to get more because they've given it away to friends or family who live outside the area of, in another state. And so of the reversals that were reported, half of them used both doses, and most of them were used on a friend. They all involved heroin. And one of the things we ask about is whether they call 911, because part of the overdose prevention education part is education about the Good Sam Law. The Good Sam Law basically says that if you are witnessing an overdose and you call 911, you would be protected from any drug possession charges. And so, you know, people will be scared to call 911, but only 12% of our clients are actually calling 911. They're still scared too. There's many reasons why. Like, people said either they felt they could handle it, or there wasn't a phone available, and a few people said they were afraid of police involvement. But that's a piece that we want to drive home, that the naloxone that we're giving out is actually a much smaller dose than what EMS gives you. So you still need to seek medical attention. We're excited that we've had this program for over a year now, and we've been doing outreach with other organizations to have naloxone more available to folks who are at risk outside of this drug user population that we're seeing. We're seeing a very small, very narrow population of folks that are with anyone who's taking chronic pain medications, for example. There are other communities that are starting to do clinic-based naloxone, so anyone that's prescribed pain meds for chronic pain, it's being treated as a safety issue, where, here's naloxone in case you start experiencing symptoms, and not using the language of an overdose, because there's stigma associated with that. But there are a lot of communities trying to expand the availability of naloxone, so that's an example. We started having a conversation with the Sheriff's Department a few months ago about Sheriff's law enforcement potentially carrying naloxone. I think the stat I got from the Sheriff's Department was 30% of the time law enforcement arrives at the scene of an overdose before EMS can get there. And then we've also done trainings with Lifeline staff. It's recommended and it's best practice to have naloxone and give naloxone to folks that are leaving treatment centers because they are at the highest risk. So there's over 600 programs like ours nationwide. They started in the early 2000s. And it's growing the different types of locations and sites. More and more law enforcement are carrying it in the state of Washington. And it's now being included as recommended practice through SAMHSA, through the CDC, through APHA. So we're excited to be rolling out this program. So I don't know if you want to add anything else about the program.
So far, I'm not aware of anybody in the county that's law enforcement that's carrying. The Chiefs Association sent an email about the program, and we had a couple of issues. One was obviously the training issue. The other is purchasing, and then the third one is the shelf life and having to make sure that your inventory is up to speed. Is it only done? Is it a syringe, or is it how's it?
There's nasal as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's my concern. Okay, I got a training that's using the syringe, but it's not used to using it. Where the person is actually using it, they're used to the syringe. So that's our holdup is okay, the training and the cost. And for us, most of the locations that you see this being used very high density, a lot of population based, where a lot of times, you know, you're right, they'll beat the fire department there, but in our community, we were trying to figure out how many times we've done an overdose before we got to work with the fire department. Not very much. So those are the things I'm trying to consider, you know. But eventually, obviously, just like AEDs, you know, we have AEDs in every car. I figure this will be the next thing we'll have in every car. But I prefer not to have the syringe.
Yeah. I think all the one person who are using the nasal.
Right.
People have had questions. Well, if they're unconscious, you know, does it still work? And you just spray it in. There's also an auto injector that's newer. I don't know if you saw that, but it actually talks to you. It's like this big, and it tells you inject. And, you know, you just, it's like an EpiPen. You just dip into your lung, and then wait 30 seconds or wait 2 minutes before you inject the second one.
But is there any funding out there to get any of these items for free? So, you know, I mean, that's
the auto injector,
or the nasal spray, or because I forgot what it was at those, but it was to put one in every police car or get one in every officer to use.
Right. And the shelf life is over 2 years.
Yeah. So we just have to track it. We have the ability to do that. Just one more thing to track.
There's a new law that Washington State passed that entities can now have a standing order as an entity.
Right.
Individuals, so it would help agencies.
Right.
There are some funding, there's some funding available for law enforcement.
Is it current or is it designated?
We were at the overdose summit a few months ago, and we heard that the HIDA funds have been, there's allocations for naloxone. And so I think that's how the Portland police started it. So,
The cost is going up. We were able to get a really reasonable cost, and so we just could it not do it because of the cost effectiveness is so expensive versus the cost of a life. So
but I do agree with you. Yeah. You know, the first person to have to, that first the individual of the household,
right,
or the drug user, because that makes the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then but I'm I'm all for it, you know, having police cars.
I think our clients are doing a great job of getting it out to the rural parts of Clark County because they really understand that it takes longer for the events to get there. And so they're giving it to their peers and their families, knowing that.
Are you tracking how many overdoses are occurring also with this? Because my understanding is that naloxone metabolizes faster than the effects of heroin often. So are you finding that since only 12% are calling 911 that they're still overdosing meds?
For all the cases, the incidents that were reported to us, the person was okay. So of the records that we have, we don't know. We haven't heard stories of someone using it and then
not surviving.
And actually, several of the cases that they didn't call 911, they took them to the ER themselves. So,
when will we get the data from this program started just a little over a year ago? When will we expect the data? I would expect a pretty dramatic decrease.
Looking at the overdose deaths.
Yeah.
So we track overdose deaths. Well, I mean, so the data on here is 2013,
right?
So it's the end of this year, that's the 2014 data. And so we started early 2014. So we might start seeing change, but we're one community, one entity.
And there is overdose prevention done by EMS.
The other thing is there not a state agency you could contact, like most hospitals or clinics, buying in bulk is cheaper. I'm sure there's other communities in Washington that are purchasing this. Is there not a conglomerate, or can you form a conglomerate to purchase it?
So we do purchase in bulk, and we actually, the rate that we're getting is a rate that basically health departments nationwide are getting specifically for the injectable. So for the nasal and auto-injectors, it's different. But in the state of Washington, there are syringe exchanges that are doing this. There are other clinics that are also doing this.
We did get a grant from Age United to do kind of a startup to free resources up. It was a syringe access grant that freed up some of our resources by buying syringes so that we could buy some naloxone. So that was really helpful in getting it started. It was still really inexpensive use of our resources.
Why is the usage up so much? Do you guys know what factors are?
People that were using prescription opioids and became addicted and could no longer have access to opioids for pain relief. Use heroin now.
So my understanding is cheaper than that too.
Yeah.
So it's cheaper.
Unfortunately, it's attractive to younger people because it is less expensive.
And it's so addictive. One usage and it's such.
Well, and then it opens up so many potential public health problems, which is the sharing of the needles, which is why the needle exchange program is so critically important. The HIV prevention that they're doing just with the needle exchange program alone is fantastic. So, and there's a lot of other issues that go along with this. It's not just the overdose of the drug, but it's also all these other public health issues that come up. So it really is it's a really good program, and we're excited not only to see this data come out, but I'm sure we'll have some additional data once we have a little bit more information at the end of the year. But I don't think, like Adina said, I don't think it's perfect because it's really hard to get demographic information and this kind of information. The self-report is really difficult to get sometimes from this clientele, but I think they've done a terrific job of getting what they have been able to get, and the feedback that they have been able to get has been fantastic. So
we also want families who have a family member that is using opiates to be able to access our resources at Church of Change.
So Trevor, I think Adiba was going to jump in too, if you don't mind. And we had a little bit, some additional information from the Healthy Youth Survey with regard to youth depression and suicide. So we're going to send around some information on that really quickly. We'll talk about that briefly. And then we can bring some additional information back to you in July.
Yes, I just, this is just a kind of a brief update. The Healthy Youth Survey presented on a few months ago, but the Department of Health and DSHS are releasing the data in news releases and small pieces. So this week they're planning to do a news release on the data related to depression and mental health and suicide. And so the handout that you have is just the local version of the state data that's about to come out. And so we were just reviewing this data today, and so I just thought I'd kind of share with you as a highlight about what some of our trends are looking like. for the most part, we are mirroring the state trends, but the indicators of depression, suicide consideration, attempts are getting worse and are pretty alarming. So I just thought it'd be nice to share some of this data, and then maybe at a future meeting we can delve into a little bit more and look deeper into the disparities and trends. So just briefly, about 34% of Hart County 10th graders are reporting feeling sad or hopeless every day for 2 weeks in a row, so much so that they've stopped doing usual activities. And this stat is actually significantly worse than 2010, when about 29% reported. So it's gone up from 29% to 34%. 20% of Clark 10th graders have seriously considered suicide, significantly increased from about 16% in 2010. And about 10% of 10th graders have reported attempted suicide. Significant increase again from 2012, which was 8%, and then 2010, which was 7%. So very alarming. The survey also asked about whether they feel like they have adults that they can go to for support if they're feeling depressive feelings. And 16% of part-time savers report they don't have any adults to turn to when they feel sad or depressed, and 6% increase in 2012, and it was 13% back then. So again, alarming rates. The handout that I gave you covers a few more indicators for your reference, but there will be some media attention around it this week, and so this will be a topic that we can talk about a little further, and maybe how ACEs work, you know, can influence some of these issues that we're looking at.
I think the one thing that caught me was that on the report that Adiba did, was suicide is the second leading cause of death for Washington teens aged 15 to 19 years old. That floored me. I had no idea. So that's why this ACEs work is so important as well, and some of the other work that we're doing around ACEs, because it's really a critical issue, and one that we want to definitely address in the public health arena. So we'll bring back some additional information for you. I don't know if you have any questions or any specific information from this that you would like us to delve into a little bit more deeply, or we'll be giving you an update probably at the next meeting. Okay. Thank you, guys.
Okay, let's move to ACE's update, the AWARE grant. I think Sam's going to hand out a few copies for us and give us a general review update on the AWARE grant.
So if you would mind with me, can we take a moment or two of silence for this child who committed suicide last evening and attended Prairie High School? It's been a long 24 hours, and the SMART team responded to the building this morning, and I was there about 4 hours. So if you wouldn't mind doing that before we discuss this important work, that'd help. Thank you. I want to talk about, and I'm about to present today, about an initiative that we wrote last summer. It was a $10 million grant that the Obama administration put out. It was based on a grant called Safe Schools, Healthy Students that in my work at ESD 112, we were lucky enough to receive in Calhoun County for 5 years. So that grant ended. We were 2007 recipients, and it ended in 2011. Based on that work, Safe Schools, Healthy Students had to do with 5 different component areas. The Obama administration changed that grant to be this new one, and that was in response to Sandy Hook. And this new grant has a lot of focus on mental health services. So I'll talk about that today. The grant itself, we had to choose 3 school districts in the state of Washington. Those 3 districts are Marysville, Shelton, and Battleground School District. Battleground is the largest district in the state. The other primary partner involved in this is the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, our statewide office. So those are the 4 major grantees. The grant itself has 2 different components. One of the components is on, and I'll talk about that today, it's on the page in front of you, and we'll discuss it. The first 2 of these goals are in component 1, and the 3rd goal is in component 2. Component 2 is about youth mental health first aid, and that is a training for lay people, just regular everyday people, anybody we can rope into, coming to an 8-hour training about youth mental health first aid, what to look for, a youth presents in certain ways, and how to help them. Think of CPR first aid, it's about mental health first aid. We're required in the grant, and ESD, Educational Services 112, is the recipient of about $240,000 a year, including this year and the next 4 years, to train up as many folks in the Battleground community as we can get. We're allowed to expand that community focus if we run out of folks. So we will be offering ESD is training at least 3, maybe 4 people a year. And those trainers have to do 3 trainings a year in order to keep their certificates. So by the time we get through 5 years, there are going to be a gazillion people who are both training and providing training. So I'll give you information about that and update you on that. It's a very good training. I went to training myself, and it's quite a bit of great information. The other 2 components, component 1 and 2, if you look at your handout here, this is what we're going to do in the Battleground School District. The first goal is to improve school climate and safety. And this is a lot of evaluators speak, so just skip down to the second box. First level, like all these primary gaps and whatever. But not to diminish that. But okay. Anyway, what we're going to do, there's something called positive behavior intervention systems, and that is a really, I don't know how to say this, but it's a real popular way for schools right now to look at their overall school climate and to put in a program that affects everybody, teach everyone in the building, children and adults, how you're supposed to behave, and then do positive rewards for doing that behavior. And then if you look at it, think of a pyramid, then you go, about 80% of kids respond to that. So you tell them what to do and you positively reward them, they'll do it. They'll come to class on time and be prepared and try to work. About 15% of kids need more intervention than that. That's a second tier in our triangle. And those children get special help around mental health services and counseling. counseling help and so on. And then you've got a top of the pyramid is about 5% of children, and they have some problems that are very severe. Does that make sense? Okay. So positive PBIS, when it says implement and expand that, our goal in Battleground is the scale of every single building, there are 18, every one of them, to implement a positive behavior intervention system that overlays on top of all the learning objectives they have, and to teach every child in every building how they're to behave and give them positive rewards for it. Which is fun. It's a lot of work. Okay. The second one is implement and enhance the school-wide data collection system. I love data. It drives the work I do. It drives everybody else's life, and it's going to drive a whole bunch of teachers and everybody in the world and Battleground before this is over. There's a system to collect data on a daily basis about what's happening, where it's happening, who it's happening to, and if we can get everybody on the same page with that, bring up some lovely stuff that's going to show us how to intervene in ways that make sense. That makes sense? That's another big one. Then we're going to hire student assistance professionals to help with the implementation of all secondary buildings. That means all middle schools and high schools are going to have a dedicated, at least half-time person to do prevention intervention. Okay. Any questions on that? So the second piece is increased mental health services. We're going to, there will be an RFP, a request for proposal that goes out to the community for $100,000 a year of mental health services that we've driven out in Battleground schools. Our goal there is to have a mental health professional in every single building. That will result, remember our triangle, where those top two tiers of kids who have real needs get referred to those mental health people and they get therapy during the day, or we're trying to reduce the barriers of transportation. Access is everything. We want kids who need it and their families to get access to mental health care if it's something that we think they need or their family thinks they need or whatever. Okay. So we're going to implement a universal screening tool. We're going to develop and implement a referral system with all those wonderful, wonderful teachers and everyone else who works in a building to say if a child presents this way, please refer them to this person who gatekeeps and then refer them on. Okay. We're going to deliver school-based mental health services, like I said, provide staff training, engage parents, and collaborate with local and state partners to address policy and funding strategies. Right. Okay. So we have what's called a core management team. We're going to invite those key leaders in our community together. We're going to try to collaborate as a group for the next 4 years beyond this year. Finally, sorry for taking too long, we're going to do youth mental health first aid, and that training plan has to do with training a gazillion people in Battleground and that community to help look for signs and symptoms of children who need help, and it refers back to that whole system I just talked about referring kids, getting their parents involved, getting them the help they need. All that in addition to reading, writing, and arithmetic out in Battleground. I will add one more note, and that is that I don't know if this is new, but I have accepted a position in the Battleground School District to be their director of student learning and professional health. That position starts July 1, so I'm leaving ESD 112 after 23 years and moving to the Battleground School District. Of course, I got hired at ESD when I was 12. I only have about 3 more years until I have 30 years in the system, so it's about really looking at what I want those last few years in before. Thank God in heaven I can retire or think about that. And working in a district allows me to do some concentrated work, and it's a job that I've dreamed about for a long time. So anyway, that's not me. But questions about this grant? Anybody have any questions? Karen?
I was just wondering about the system, the mental health system that's already set up in schools. I know they have school psychologists, but I think they're like part-time.
Mm-hmm.
Will this grant like expand those services or be in addition to?
So each, that's a really good question. Each building has at least a counselor and they have a second battleground. And the psychologist, now people think of counselors and you gotta expand your framework a little bit. Counselors in schools, especially secondary schools, do a lot of scheduling, and they're schedulers. They do counseling work, but they don't have a lot of time for that. The psychologists also do a lot of work around special education. But actual work around therapy and helping children is not something that's built in necessarily to the degree it needs to be in their jobs. So those folks are going to stay, and they're going to be primary partners in each building for us. Around gate, when I say gatekeeping, I mean that you can imagine. If you go into a 2,000-person kid high school and you say to the principal or the counseling staff, do you have anybody who needs mental health help? It's a list of about 20% of the kids. So we have to do some work around, okay, who really is prioritized here, and the sites and counselors are going to help us with that. Because they know all the kids. That's the theory going forward.
So, I had a question about the families. So this says that the part of the grant is really get the parents engaged in this. Are the kids going to have parental permission to get counseling?
Yes and no. It depends on your age. If you're 13 years or older in the state of Washington, you can seek and receive your own mental health and chemical dependency assistance. So if you're a little person, yes, it's not required. They have to give authorization, which is a lot of a big deal. We can't certainly. If they're older than that, technically I don't think we have to, but it's been my past practice in my other positions and probably will be going forward that in all cases we want to engage parents as much as possible. It's just the best way to serve children. But you can't, I mean, we don't have the request for proposal out yet, and we don't know. We also are in interesting times because the way that services are distributed in this particular county is changing. We are moving into a new system of mental health services going out. I won't go into that, but for early adopters, it's a big, interesting situation. So we're trying as hard as possible to leverage what's already happening in the county with providers and have them give us as much as humanly possible, $100,000 additional money.
The goals and objectives overarching of the AWARE grant is for the recipients to set up a framework or template for other districts, regardless of size, to be able to leverage. Is that?
It's, I didn't bring those. The overall goal is sustainability. So we start from day one saying how at the end of this 5 years can we sustain this and go forward. The other overall goal is the feds handed out about 20 of these to states who picked 3 school districts to pilot all the stuff that's happening. And yes, they want to spread the good news, see what works, have other districts adopt as much as possible and make it replicable. Been interesting though, they just changed the whole first year. We haven't been able to spend money because you have to have a plan that's approved by the feds. They told us like 3 weeks ago that we couldn't do drug and alcohol services with our mental health services. Oh, don't forget that. So we were like, oh, the money's from the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. How does that work exactly? That was an interesting call. So it's the first full year has just figured it out, and the feds have just released the funds, so no one's ever done this particular grant before, so it's been challenging. It
needs to be. Anyway. And I know that we're working with, being in Battleground, all the kids that have no mental health issues, suicides, I meet Wednesday night with a group of homeowners associated with a child who's 11, 12 years old, severe mental health issues where he's basically danger to others, but there's just no system in place, long-term system that we can care for this child until he does something really bad, and then we'll all intervene and do something then because we have somebody that's been injured. The other thing we're looking at doing is, I just finished a grant, I'm going to submit it on Friday. It's through the COPS office, and it's not a lot of money, but it's $75,000 over 2 years I'm going to look at a part-time employee that is, I'm going to call a community outreach coordinator, and all they're going to do is, maybe this is all hypothetical because it's in my head here and it's pretty scary, But we're going to put this person in like the detective unit, and they'll review all the police reports and look at all the calls and stuff like that. And they'll just do the same thing. They'll be a gatekeeper that coordinates with, okay, this kid is in the school system. Let's work with Project Aware. Alcohol and drug issues. Let's work with Prevent Together Coalition. We need to do some ACEs education in the community. Let's work with the Department of Health. We need to work with the victims advocates. So that's what our goal is, to have kind of a gatekeeper within the police department that works with these families that we come in contact with and say, oh, by the way, you have these services over here. We're not going to provide services, but we're going to direct people to the right place. And then on top of that, do some community outreach, crime prevention, those kinds of things. So that's what we're kind of working on right now. And hopefully we can team it up with everything else that's going on in our community. So.
Any other questions or inquiries in regards to the Aware grant?
I just had one follow-up question. So I was just curious, Sandy. So with your role changing, how's your role with the grant? Does that change?
It's been an interesting So leading after 22 years is a lot of unknowns. But basically what's happening is I'm going to Battleground to run the Aware grant. And probably counselors in the district as well and some other students to be assigned. So I'm not sure. I haven't started yet. And then right now I'm doing both those jobs and then trying to transition out. So I'll be able to answer it better. But the Aware grant is primary in terms of my responsibility.
So you'll be writing the RFP when you start?
We have an interview on Thursday. That would be 2 days from now for the mental health lead for this position, for this grant. So I'm very excited to interview people who would love to write that RFP. I am thrilled to death that we got some great candidates. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay, thank you, Teddy.
Sure.
Community Foundation grant update.
So to dovetail off of what Sandy was just talking about the Aware grant, we were awarded the Community Foundation grant, which is $50,000 for 3 years. And the focus of this is really in cooperation with what Sandy and Bob and the rest of the partners are doing in Battleground. And the idea around this is that this grant will serve to provide ACEs education awareness, and it'll be layered into what the Aware grant is going to be doing as far as training. So this is going to bring some additional dollars, but specifically around ACEs and around ACEs training in that area. And the focus is really on providing sector-specific ACEs training, so law enforcement, school personnel, juvenile justice, faith and family organizations in the Battleground area. And so not only what Aware is doing within the schools, but it's also to make sure that the community also has that foundation of trauma-informed ACEs education is really what this is going to be focused on. The intent is to develop, also with regard to that awareness, will be to develop a train-the-trainer program to ensure that resident ACEs experts are in place in these participating organizations within that community. And the idea there is that they will help other organizations to also become trauma-informed and understand what ACEs are, what an ACE score is, what ACEs are, and how that impacts mental health, and also, you know, and also violence and things in our youth. We're also intending to develop an online ACEs resource that will provide training and links. So in addition to train-the-trainers, we will have this database of online resources that will be available to the community in Battleground and throughout the area. So basically, I mean, over time, what we're hoping to see is that with all these efforts that are happening, is a reduction in, you know, juvenile arrest, but youth violence and suicide rates, that sort of a thing, reduction in school absenteeism, reduction in school dropout, reduction in teen pregnancy, homelessness, drug use, all of those things that seem to be impacting our youth this time. So
Ideally, that's what we're going to do with these funds, and over time, I think we're going to have a it's great to be able to leverage the kind of work that they're doing in Battleground and bring some additional focus in that area with regard to ASA-specific training. So right now, we just got the grant, so we're working on setting up the stakeholder meetings, and then we're also working with the DEBA and the HA18 to collect some baseline data and some evaluation criteria, so we're working on that right now. And so we'll be having some more information around this. All right, any questions on that? Okay. And then really quickly, too, I wanted to give you an update on where we are with the ACES Collaborative. So we've developed in Clark County organization, for lack of a, you know, if you guys can help us come up with a name for it, we would greatly appreciate that. We might have like a lotto or something, or some sort of a giveaway with the best name. Right now we're calling it the ACES Collaborative, but we really are looking for a different name. It's about 40 organizations now that are involved at this time, and we keep adding more key organizations in the leadership capacity. They came together about 2 months ago. They're developing their mission statement, but they've already formed some ideas around what they want to work on, and they've developed now 5 separate work groups within the collaborative. They're identifying an assessment tool that employers can use to be trauma-informed and to be ACEs-sensitive. They're also drafting a list of questions to map a process to identify ACEs-informed programs and services in our community. So we're actually looking to try to map some of those things out, which I think will help definitely with what you guys are doing in Battleground. And we're looking at launching some community-wide educational events in late September or early October. I think we talked a little bit about that at some prior meetings. We also had a speaker in last month from the DOH that was reporting at the state level what they're doing there, and we may actually bring her in as a speaker later on at one of our FAT meetings coming up in the future. So there's a lot of work going on around the ACEs issue, and I think we'll be able to share some additional information about what the collaborative is doing and how those work groups, where they are with the work that they're doing in the community. Any questions on that? Okay, super. Thank you.
Okay. Any other topic of discussion for this evening? Anybody?
Monday.
Oh, okay. So I'll be gone too.
No hurry. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. When did you want to be the next
up? Oh, I usually get it. I'll probably get it early next week.
Okay.
Okay.
So I'll see you
Tuesday or Wednesday.
Yeah. All right.
Sure. All right. Wow. Gosh. Gotta call my
caterer.
So, folks, you saw the containers.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
So I believe that this one belongs to Struggling, but
I think you could both go upstairs somewhere. There are some. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah. Are you excited?
Oh, yes. It's nice to fun.
sadly, because...
So where's the grant party?
Grant party the night of...
Oh, really?
They shipped us off 20 minutes after the ceremony ended, so...
Okay. So where did you guys go?
I actually didn't participate in the party. I didn't know who was in town, so I decided to spend the evening.
I'll let you know. We got 4 years.
I chaperoned that one time many years ago.
They're crazy. Yeah. You can sleep until 6 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, in fact, it's really a lot
harder. Right.
Yeah. Well, very cool. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Did you see the email that I sent? Okay. I apologize for explaining that. I was out of cell coverage for a day.
No problem at all. I hope you're good.
I will be here.
Well,
keep it going.